This is an MIT Press Journals podcast.
This is Bill Fowler with the New England Quarterly. NEQ is one of America's oldest scholarly journals, and it focuses on the New England history and culture from the very beginning of New England to the present moment. And today, I'm here with a New England Quarterly author, David Nomick, who has done a fascinating article, David, quite fascinating, in the current December issue, having to do with Native Americans in Connecticut, having to do with the Civil War, race, ethnicity. I think you really touch a number of different topics, which I found most interesting. And I'd like to begin by simply asking you, how did you come upon this topic?
Frankly, I've always been interested in the American Civil War. That's one of the topics I've just come to research over the years, come to grow and love. While I was doing undergraduate work at UConn, much of my studies were also involved in public history, museum studies. I managed to take an internship at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum in southeastern Connecticut. And I was aware of Native presence in southern New England, but at that point in my career, I haven't really focusing on it much. It was a new experience. And I was lucky enough to work with a senior researcher at the time, Toby Glaza, and understanding my interest in the Civil War, he shows me that wonderful image of Amasa Lawrence, who's...
That's part of the journal. It's a wonderful photograph.
Oh, yeah. I thank the Pequot Museum for allowing us to use it. It's fascinating on a number of levels. For me, I thought it was just very interesting knowing that this man was an Indian, Mashantucket Pequot, and served in the American Civil War, this topic I knew and loved. When I found out what regiment, 29th Connecticut Volunteers, immediately understood that was a regiment of color, and up until that point, I always considered it a unit just fully manned with African Americans and white officers.
Now, how well identified were Native Americans or Indians in the Civil War? I noticed in your article you used census material quite extensively. And I was struck by the uncertainty and kind of the cloudedness of census material. And I thought you used a great deal of imagination probing through that information to get at the real essence of the story. And if you could talk about that and also the database. You mentioned in one of your footnotes, I always read the footnotes, this remarkable database that's been developed.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say, Mashantucket Pequot Museum, the research department, which is one of the many departments in the museum, along with archaeology and information resources, where we collect any and all data we can on Native American peoples in North America, but specifically we focus on local history, and that of not only the Mashantucket tribe, but the other tribal nations of southern New England. This database, the issue we always dealt with were these records were so numerous and diverse in nature, you name it, court records, vital records, maritime records, seamen's protection papers, military records. It's hard to keep track of these populations, of this community. Very mobile, not always understood by these Euro-American record keepers. We see this diverse nature of descriptions, as I wrote about, ranging from anything from black to colored to yellow to Indian. It seems to be a visual description of the record keeper at the time. We have plenty of modern examples and examples of the late 19th century of Native peoples describing how they seek to be described as such, Indian, in the record, but the record keeper doesn't allow that and inserts their own description of race, white, color, whatnot.
That's an intriguing thing. I mean, obviously historians are always victims of record keepers. Those of us who work from documents depend upon those who created the documents. And I was intrigued, the point that you make in your essay, one of the many very good points, is that in many ways these record keepers made Native Americans disappear. They simply disappeared. And I was struck by Crevecoeur's comment when he was traveling through America in the late 18th century, when he says, and you quote him here, "What is become of those numerous tribes which formerly inhabited the extensive shores of the Great Bay of Massachusetts?" And, of course, the implication being that they are no longer with us.
That was one of the most fascinating aspects of this research that only became more clear the longer I worked at the Pequot Museum Research Department Archaeology, the nature of how these perceptions of race change incredibly from the Revolution to the period of the Civil War and beyond, and what a difficult just nature of research it is for many historians to get their hands around. That particular quote was fascinating. It was brought to my attention by the current senior researcher at the Pequot Museum, Jason Mancini, who's done an incredible amount of work on Indians in the maritime world, relying on the Seamen's Protection papers, part of the customs records, namely Port of New London. And it's just incredible. We literally have done studies tracking particular individuals. Masa Lawrence is one. Recently, the Pequot Museum hosted an exhibit on race. That was around for a period of some odd months last year. And one of our case studies was Amasa Lawrence. And using that image, we tracked Mr. Lawrence through the historical record and kept track of how arbitrarily he's been described over the years, not only he's been self-identified by signing tribal petitions, but by other record keepers. You can see descriptions ranging from black, Negro, part white, part Negro, some odd amount of Indian blood. As you go through the years from the 18-teens to the 1870s, chief of the Pequots, as on that image of Amasa Lawrence. This is a material we worked on quite a bit. Back to the database, all these records we find all over the place, it's just been, the system's been so simple it works. That is, we have created an access database where we cite these records.
Now, what records are you citing?
Though? Every record we can get our hands on that describes an individual. They can be military records, series known as the Indian Papers and the Connecticut Court Records, vital records, death, cemetery inscriptions, you name it. If it has a description of race in an individual, not even a description of race, but somebody that we know of as part of the community, we enter it into this database. You can sort it any which way. We can, all of a sudden, it just becomes very clear, these communities that begin to emerge based on surname, based on town, county, record group. You can tease out French and Indian War veterans. It's so simple it works, and it's been so very useful to our, not only ourselves, but other researchers and scholars that have come to visit. And it's been extremely helpful in this research.
And this, of course, has managed you and other scholars to see the continuous presence of Native peoples, that they have not disappeared, they are not disappearing, they've been persistently present in our culture and have had a dramatic influence on that culture. I was I'm somewhat amused, if that's the right word, about the historian you cite, John DeForest, Connecticut local historian, who asserts, of course, that there are no Native Americans and then ends up serving in a Civil War regiment in which there are Native Americans from Connecticut. It seems that Mr. DeForest didn't look very far.
I find it absolutely incredible. DeForest is absolutely and well known in Connecticut history, and anybody that speaks of or researches Native communities throughout the area, it's just a common perception of the mid 19th century, especially from the 1830s onwards. And as I write about this idea of post Revolutionary War with this changing nature of community and this very mobile nature, and the Connecticut, New England, North American Indian not exactly fitting this visual description, this idea of what it means to be Indian. DeForest is relying on reservation populations. He's relying on court records, and not actually, apparently, from what I see, actually trying to visit or speak to many of the individuals themselves. I wouldn't think he'd have to go too far in the town of Hampton to come across the Vickers in the 1850s if he really wanted to meet some Native peoples of Nipmuc descent or Native descent living in the area. But to him and others, they may have been simply considered men of color or whatnot. And personally, I think it has a lot to do with also pure and simple skin tone and how dark one is, and just the nature of the communities and intermarriage and interaction from 1630s to the 1860s, Indian populations, people self-identified as Native, just to their, I think the further away you move from their European, their communities, the town of Hampton, town of Groton, New London, those who know these people as Indian, the farther you get away, people not familiar with the community see these people of Native descent and visually consider them just simply men of color by the 18-teens onwards.
You have obviously dug very deeply in the archives. I'm wondering, in the course of your work, particularly because of where you work, and you might want to say something about that, have you had an opportunity to talk to any descendants of these men who served?
Yeah, many descendants of these Native veterans are still in the local area today, and I work with a number at the Pequot Museum. I have to definitely speak a bit more of the nature of the research department. I work alongside a number of fantastic people. Two of the senior researchers in the department, Jason Mancini, who I cite in the article, his work on maritime, natives of the maritime world, and issues of race and ethnicity are just wonderful addition to the literature. And Deborah Jones, a tribal member of Mashantucket Pequot, who's also a skilled researcher, genealogist. We all work together on these topics, and it's nice to work with such a diverse people with a diverse background with many various interests. My interest in terms of this topic, military history, I followed at Tufts, continued at the Pequot Museum. Others are interested in genealogy. I already mentioned maritime matters. It's great. We are able to cover a lot of seemingly different topics with many common threads, and it's fantastic. In terms of ancestors or descendants of these veterans, the first panel, the second page of the article, William Cogswell, I was just stunned when my coworker Trudy Lamb Richmond, director of the Education Department at the Pequot Museum, and a descendant of Mr. Cogswell, showed me this image. It's just incredible. Today, in general, when people, I find, still have these links to their past and their ancestors, especially in the Civil War. I'm a descendant of a Civil War veteran as well, who served in the 26th Connecticut Volunteer Infantry. Was also at the Battle of Port Hudson with the 76th United States Colored Infantry, who I write about, with the Vickers served in. And it's just interesting to see these mementos of that period that still survive today. So she shows me this image. Which is incredible on two accounts. For one, it's a Scaticoke tribal member, William Cogswell, well known in his community of North Cornwall at the time, known to be Indian, known to be Scaticoke, described in the records as mulatto, as I mentioned, and likely considered most parts of Connecticut, if he traveled, a man of color of the time period. We have this image of a Connecticut Indian in uniform, and he's not any uniform, the uniform of a second lieutenant of the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Volunteer Infantry. Sash, belt, frock coat, it's absolutely incredible. I've met a number of people like Trudy who are descendants of these men who fought in these regiments. And
I thought it was also fascinating that moving between regiments, that some of these men were in white regiments, Connecticut white regiments, and then transferred to the 29th or 30th Colored Infantry and became non-commissioned officers in those regiments. So there seems to have been, on one hand, a very strong racial division, but then on the other hand, this moving between these regiments I found rather odd.
I found it odd. I found it fascinating. It was almost a catalyst that convinced me to really rework sections of my thesis at Tufts, which was on these regiments of Connecticut and Rhode Island, into this journal article. I was working at the Nipmuc Tribal Archives with a tribal member and ethnohistorian archaeologist, Ray Gould, and she showed me their phenomenal archives organized by wars. So I tried to avoid looking too much into the Revolution and where else and focus on the Civil War, and I came across this account of the Vickers family. They are men of Indian descent. They aren't, I do not believe they are considered tribal members, but they were as part of this research that I believe more needs to be known about this family in Hampton. But they're certainly Indian men, and to see that they served in both the 12th Connecticut Volunteer Infantry, you can call it a white regiment excluding men of color, but these men of color serve in it. And then when the 76th comes along, they are able to resign as privates in the 12th and sign up, as you said, non-commissioned sergeants, first sergeants, corporals in the 76th, a unit that you would consider black, African-American, yet these Native men, considered men of color, can serve, in both capacities. I'm sure there's more than these three instances out there, and I just can't wait for the time to dive into it a bit further.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think you've discovered an archive and a method of looking at these archives that reveals these connections that historians simply have not looked at before.
It's difficult. It's a community method. This is what Jason Mancidi, Deborah Jones, our other interns and consultants that work with us at the museum, this is how we do the work. You can't really do it any other way, I find. That's why it is difficult to tag these, to bring these communities to light in the historic records, because they've been overlooked because you need to understand the community. Once you start working almost with these different records, these genealogical records, in a sense, working in this database format and start to recognize names as you look at military rosters, be it the 29th or the 8th Connecticut, and you notice Babcock and Mark D, and you start to then cross-reference that with records such as census records, vital records. Is this person that has signed up or is credited to the town of Old Mystic truly from that area? Is that the same Mark Babcock that is appearing on tribal records? And using, or is this the same Rensselaer Babcock appearing in the town poor records, labeled as Indian, describes his mother? Once you start cross-referencing in this way, shape, and form, relying on this community method, it really starts to bring these rosters and this data to life in a whole different way.
You know, no discussion of the service of African Americans and Native Americans in the Civil War would be complete without some reference to what I think is arguably the most famous of the black regiments, and that would be the 54th Massachusetts. And of all the things that your article revealed to me, and I'm sure to many, many readers, when I got to the very end of the article, it was almost stunning. The information you had about the 54th Regiment, and in particular, of course, about one of this country's most famous, if not the most famous, Civil War memorial, the St. Gaudens Memorial to Robert Gould Shaw in the 54th Massachusetts. And I would wonder if you would just explain to our listeners what you did, in fact, discover about the 54th and about that St. Gaudens Memorial.
Well, what I bring to light, didn't necessarily discover, because it's been known in the community in Worcester, the Worcester Historical Society, people like Ed Hood over at Sturbridge Village, long ago, that one of the musicians, the drummer boys of the 54th Massachusetts, Alexander Johnson, was in fact of Nipmuc descent. Narragansett descent. He self-identifies, which is one of the hardest aspects of this research. I mean, okay, somebody can be of Native descent, but do they consider themselves part of that community? I mean, I think the example, not to go off subject, of, say, Paul Cuffey, who is of Native descent, notably Pequot, among others, an African-American, pioneers the colonization movement, in a sense, of African-Americans back to Africa. He identified more as an African-American. Alexander Johnson identifies in documents as a Narragansett Indian, especially on his mother's side. His wife is Narragansett Indian. Both their mothers and fathers, Narragansetts. And notably, his wife has ties to the Nipmuc community I write about. She lists her, on her grandparents' side, surnames such as Vickers, we discussed, and Hemingway and Curliss, which are known in that community to have ties to Nipmuc. So these people are firmly entrenched, I feel, in the Native community. He is a mariner from New Bedford, signs up at the age of 16, and interesting, is interviewed more than once by the Worcester local newspaper, the Telegram, I want to say. And I also think it's fascinating that he mentions that he's been playing a drum or beating on a drum from the day he was, you know, able to hold one. And it's I think that's has some interesting, you could discuss that in a cultural context as well. I think it's pretty fascinating.
Well, every time I go by that monument, and I do quite often, I look at it in a very different way now, after having read your essay. It just makes the monument, in some ways, even more moving.
I'd say so. As soon as I learned of this tie with Johnson, and of course, yes, one of the most famous regiments, thanks to glory, fame, it was another motivator to write this article, to bring to light some other regiments other than the 54th, frankly, the 29th Connecticut, the 30th Connecticut, the 14th Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, not to mention these Native Guard units that started life as Confederate regiments. A lot of people don't, you know, realize or recognize the African-American soldiers of the Confederacy. That's a whole other fascinating aspect of research. I just like these stories of the Civil War, which have not been told, and it's such a rich, diverse period of American history, and it has been written consistently about from that period till present. I just think there's a whole new generation and era of stories to be told by looking at this community approach and these other people, individuals, the different racial, ethnic groups that serve in the conflict. I also wanted to, as I write about, bring across this idea of these regiments as regiments of color. Not frankly, exclusively African-American. I describe the Hawaiian man, the Asian man, people from Spain, Portugal, from other native tribes outside of the United States. There's even people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, that are serving in these regiments who aren't American citizens. Connecticut recruiters, New England recruiters, recruiters across the country are going all over the place trying to find men to serve as part of their state's quota. You see all these people from the docks in New York, recruits from outside the state of Connecticut serving for towns who are just sending recruiters out. Frankly, every individual that they can recruit to serve in these colored regiments, it's one less of their townspeople who have to serve on behalf of their town. I just think that's this topic of Native Americans, people of color in the Civil War can be discussed on so many levels. It's endless. And
Well, it certainly also helps us to understand and better appreciate our own modern period. We're helping to identify cultural persistence of Native peoples. I think it's really quite a remarkable contribution that you've made. Let me ask you something. Having mined this information and I guess gathered it as well, so what's next?
There's always, if I could pursue another topic or along this lines, I would definitely expand it into 54th, 55th Mass, 5th Mass Cav, all colored units. I found a number of men of Nipmuc descent that are known within the Nipmuc tribal community that have served, as well as Narragansetts. I'd be surprised if I see any Mohegan or Pequot serving in those Massachusetts units, but the Massachusetts tribes, Mashpee, certainly represented in those regiments and the Union Navy as well. This can be repeated, expanded upon in most of the southern New England states, and I really wish I could follow that up further. The 14th Rhode Island Heavy Artillery is a fascinating unit, which I devoted a chapter to in my thesis at Tufts University, and you know, that might be another future article. But at the Pequot Museum, we're also working alongside the National Park Service, received a grant from the American Battlefield Protection Program, and I am working as the lead researcher on that project, identifying battlefields of the Pequot War, 1636 to 38, in southern New England. And we have sites in Groton, Connecticut, Fairfield, Connecticut, Old Saybrook, Block Island, and even up in upstate New York that we're considering surveying. We're doing additional historical research into, and we're hoping to include in eventually the Battlefield Protection Program alongside places like Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, and Yorktown. So.
Well, whatever you do as you continue on, I hope you're going to keep in mind the New England Quarterly. It's been a delight working with you, and I think this is an extraordinarily important article. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure working with you and Linda Rhodes, and it's been a great experience all in all. I hope people enjoy the article.
They will indeed.
For more information about this article, the New England Quarterly, or any of our publications, please visit our website at www.mitpressjournals.org.